This is VOA News in Washington. I'm Jeff Custer. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu repeated Thursday Israel's plans to launch a military operation into the Gaza city of Rafah. The United States, the United Nations, and other nations have urged Israel to reconsider such a military incursion into the southern Gaza city, where more than a million displaced Palestinians are reportedly sheltering. But Netanyahu insists Israel must invade Rafah to fight the last four battalions of Hamas said to be located there. Speaking in Tel Aviv Thursday, Netanyahu repeated that Israel will do what is necessary to secure the country's security, including in Rafah. As he concluded his visit to Israel Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken repeated U.S. opposition to such a plan.
Our position is clear. It hasn't changed. It won't change. We cannot, will not support a major military operation in Rafah absent an effective plan to make sure that civilians are not harmed. And no, we've not seen such a plan.
Blinken said the U.S. continues to discuss with Israel alternatives to invading Rafah to reach Hamas. U.S. President Joe Biden Thursday defended free speech and the right to protest while condemning those who would break the law to do so. As police have cracked down on campus demonstrations across the country, shutting down encampments or trying to and making hundreds of arrests, Biden, speaking from the White House, said two fundamental American principles, the right to free speech and the rule of law, are being put to the test and both must be upheld. He said it's not a moment for political points. It's a moment for clarity.
So let me be clear. Violent protest is not protected. Peaceful protest is. It's against the law when violence occurs. Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest.
This is VOA News. The U.S. Director of National Intelligence said Thursday the U.S. is facing an increasingly complex and interconnected threat environment characterized by three categories of challenges. Director Avril Haines laid out the challenges to the U.S. Senate Arms Services Committee on Capitol Hill.
The first is an accelerating strategic competition with major authoritarian powers that are actively working to undermine the rules-based order and the open international system, which the United States and our partners rely on for trade, for commerce, and for the free flow of information.
Haines cited the second set of challenges as cybersecurity, terrorism, climate change, narcotics trafficking, and health security. And the third, regional and localized tensions, including those that have erupted into full-blown conflicts with far-reaching global implications. She said all three categories are affected by trends in new and emerging technologies, environmental changes, and economic strain that is stoking global insecurity. Georgia's parliament Wednesday approved the second reading of a bill on foreign agents, which European Union officials have condemned as Kremlin-inspired and unacceptable. The measure would require organizations receiving more than 20% of their funding from abroad to register as agents of foreign influence. Opponents say the bill will lead to a crackdown on freedom of speech. Reuters correspondent Leila Shahrakshahi reports.
Ever-growing numbers of protesters have been taking to the streets in the capital, Tbilisi, for almost a month, with Wednesday's numbers in the tens of thousands leading to police firing tear gas and stun grenades at the large crowds who oppose the draft law. Georgia's health ministry said 11 people, including six police officers, had received hospital treatment after Wednesday's altercations. Georgian critics have dubbed the bill the Russian law, saying it is inspired by laws used to suppress dissidents in Vladimir Putin's Russia. Russia is unpopular among many citizens of Georgia, which lost a brief war with Moscow in 2008.
That's Leila Shahrakshahi reporting. The body of a fifth missing worker has been found more than a month after a Baltimore bridge collapse. AP correspondent Haya Panjwani reports.
One more body has been recovered after the collapse of the Key Bridge in Baltimore. Authorities say the body of a fifth person who went missing after the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore has been recovered. Six members of a roadwork crew plunged to their deaths on March 26th when a container ship lost power and crashed into one of the bridge's supporting columns. Officials announced that the victim found was identified as 49-year-old Miguel Angel Luna Gonzalez of Glen Burnie, Maryland. All of the victims were Latino immigrants who came to the United States from Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. I'm Haya Panjwani.
In Washington, I'm Jeff Custer. This is VOA News.
Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. Yehayes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
In sub-Saharan Africa, the IMF estimates that nearly $70 billion will be needed as gross external financing for low-income economies annually.
That was VOA's Ignatius Anor on estimates by the IMF and World Bank on the external support needed for poor countries in sub-Saharan Africa each year. Details coming up. Also, President Biden defends the right to protest over the war in Gaza, but insists order must prevail. And Russia has begun deploying troops under the banner of African Corps in southern Libya. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The International Monetary Fund says Niger and Senegal are among sub-Saharan Africa's fast-growing economies due to their oil and gas resources. In its 2024 economic outlook in the region, the Bretton Woods Institution says it is upbeat about a good regional economic recovery, but adds that growth has been more sluggish than expected. VOA's Ignatius Anor reports from Washington.
The IMF says a bright light lies ahead for sub-Saharan Africa economies after 4 years of weathering the storm. The International Monetary Fund, however, says with governments facing a financial squeeze amid high borrowing costs and future debt repayments, there's a risk to the region's economic outlook. Abebe Ambo Selassie is the director of the IMF's Africa Department.
The good news is that, you know, there is some recovery taking place in the region. Growth was 3.4% in 2023, expecting to go up to about 3.8% this year, and a bit further to around 4% next year. Countries have had to live a lot more within their means. Institutions like mine, the World Bank, have, of course, stepped forward. Just to give you a small example, you know, I think since 2020, the IMF has provided financing to the tune of $58 billion just to the sub-Saharan African countries. The World Bank has also been providing quite a bit of support as countries have not had access to markets in recent years.
Abebe says the emergence of natural resources like oil and gas in Niger and Senegal this year will spur a growth expansion of 10.4% and 8.3% respectively in these West African states.
The only thing that they have in common, as you said, is that both, it so happens, are going to have a new oil production coming on stream. And that will bump up GDP the output numbers. We are also looking to see how we can support the government in Niger, and we're hopeful that we can reach agreement on you know, we have a program that we're supporting under the Resilience and Sustainability Trust to help them address the climatic shocks. So we're hopeful that we can move forward in supporting them also in the coming weeks.
The IMF also notes the demographic boom in sub-Saharan Africa, but regrets that despite direct global foreign investments giving access to stable finance and job creation, sub-Saharan Africa is attracting only a mere 3%.
As important as domestic investment, I think too often domestic investors and by far the predominant role they play in driving economic activity is ignored. And in fact, foreign direct investment investors often come to invest in countries where they see domestic investors reaping a lot of dividends. I mean, that's a very important signaling in domestic investment itself being conducive.
As the IMF and World Bank emphasizes that badly needed reforms will require time to mature and deliver results, it is calling for international support and solidarity for economies in sub-Saharan Africa. The IMF estimates that nearly $70 billion will be needed as gross external financing for low-income economies annually. Ignatius Anor, VOA News, Washington.
A short time ago, U.S. President Joe Biden defended the right to protest, but insisted that order must prevail as college campuses across the country face unrest over the war in Gaza. In comments at the White House, Biden said the protests have not caused him to reconsider his approach to the war. Biden, a Democrat, has criticized Israel's conduct but continued to supply it with weapons. His rival in the presidential race, former President Donald Trump, today praised police officers who have cleared some campus protests. The Military Africa website reports Russia has begun deploying troops under the banner of the Africa Corps in southern Libya. Russian cargo planes were seen offloading scores of soldiers at Barak al-Shati, while cargo ships carrying equipment docked at the port of Tobruk. Armaments and other Greek gear for the Africa Corps have arrived via Russian naval landing ships. This deployment is part of Russia's efforts to consolidate a formidable military presence in Africa. Wolfgang Porstai, senior advisor to the Austrian Institute for Security, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi how significant this move is for Russian influence in Africa.
In Africa, actually, Russia's strategy focuses primarily on the military instrument of state power, namely the mercenaries of what is now called Africa Corps. Therefore, the delivery of a larger amount of military hardware by ship to Libya is a very significant development, as it indicates the further build-up of Russian military power in North Africa, and I'm pretty sure further deliveries by ship will follow. The equipment offloaded is exactly what is required by the mercenaries in their wars against the jihadists and various rebel groups in sub-Saharan Africa on behalf of the governments there. The Barak al-Shati Air Force Base, located in Libya south, just about 500 kilometers from the border to Niger, seems to serve as a forward staging area for this equipment. From there, it could be brought easily further down to the south. I would say, while it cannot be entirely ruled out that part of this military hardware stays in Libya, it can be assumed that the final destination for most of it is Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger and the Central African Republic, and maybe even other countries in the region.
So that means Russia is aiming to establish the core structure of African Corps by summer of 2024, with plans to operate in other African nations, as you said, Burkina Faso, Mali, Central Republic, and Niger. How would Libya represent for the Russian expansion into Africa?
Libya has a key role in this. It is actually the key element for the Russia military operations in Africa. It serves as a refueling base for transport aircraft, namely Al-Qadim, about 100 kilometers east of Benghazi, Unverdan at the Jufro Oasis, 220 kilometers south of Sirte, and as said, as a logistic hub and a staging area probably at the Barak al-Shati base. The easiest way for Russia to provide logistics for their many contingents in sub-Saharan Africa by air and sea is via Libya. Without Libya as a gateway, it would be extremely difficult for the Russians to sustain, let alone expand their military operations in Africa. Some analysts predict that Russia intends to establish a navy base in Tobruk, but I disagree. This would not make a lot of sense for Russia. They have a modern navy base in Latakia in Syria, just about 36 hours by ship from Tobruk. And Latakia can harbor all kinds of Russian warships, except their sole aircraft carrier and their nuclear cruiser, which are in a very poor condition anyway and which belong to the Russian Northern Fleet. A navy base in Tobruk would be just 380 kilometers away from major NATO air bases in Crete, and as such, very vulnerable to airstrikes.
Unlike the previous denial of Wagner Group's connection to the Russian military, a key component of the African Corps will be directly subordinate to the Ministry of Defense in Russia. Oversight will be provided by Deputy Defense Minister Yunusbek Yevorkov, a former president of the Russian Republic of Ingushetia. This new military force comprises former Wagner Group operatives and private security contractors affiliated with the Russian companies operating in Africa. What do you make of that?
The mercenary operations will be even more aligned with the Russian strategic objectives in Africa. Keeping in mind that Russia needs the vast majority of its military resources, including especially well-trained infantry and transport aircraft, in the war against Ukraine, it is important for them to use the mercenaries in Africa in a well-coordinated way, coordinated with the other Russian instruments of state power, namely diplomacy, but also with the economic instrument. However, Wagner units in Africa operated already before they were rebranded to Africa Corps very closely with the GRU, Russia's military intelligence agency. But this relationship was not without frictions. Now, mercenary operations will be directly tasked, led, and coordinated by the GRU, and we can expect that they will be even more capable, as they will have now direct access to other Russian military assets.
That was Wolfgang Porstei, senior advisor to the Austrian Institute for Security, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. <laughs> 2024 has been dubbed the year of elections. Nowhere is it truer than in Africa, where 19 countries are holding presidential and parliamentary elections. Mutuko Mumo is Africa's program coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ. With Press Freedom Day looming tomorrow, Mutoki starts by explaining to me the opportunities for increased democratization in African nations through press freedom, access to information and free elections, most importantly, without internet disruptions.
So yes, it is an exciting year in terms of elections. So many people are going to the polls or have already gone to the polls, for instance, in the case of Senegal, in 2024. To be citizen at this time, to have the opportunity to exercise your freedom to vote is quite exciting. Now, what role does the media play not only in this electoral process but in broader democratization? We can say, first of all, the media has a duty, a responsibility to keep the public informed about the issues on which they are voting, the candidates who are standing up and seeking the public's vote. It's a fundamental duty of the media to do that and to keep an eye on the electoral process, you know, from the moment when people go to cast their vote to when those ballots are counted. But we can also look at the flip side of this. It is also an opportunity for reform. When you have governments being given new mandates or when you have new governments coming into place, and we hope that those governments prioritize press freedom and see that the value that the media has in the democratic process and in their societies. So we're looking at those transition moments as moments where we as people, you know, campaigning for press freedom, but also the public in general can demand, can ask for greater freedoms for the press that keeps them informed.
Mutuki, talk to us about internet shutdowns.
As a committee to protect journalists, we do consider internet shutdowns to be a threat to the safety of journalists and something that undermines press freedom. Now, why do we say this? While internet shutdowns are a tool of broad censorship that affects everyone, regardless of whether they are a journalist or a teacher or a carpenter, we believe that because of the nature of the work that journalists do, an internet shutdown has particular effects that undermine the freedom to do that work and the safety of the person doing that work. How do they do this? If you are a journalist operating in today's environment, you need to be able to collect news very quickly, and you need to be able to do so in a safe way. Most times, journalists are using messaging applications which are encrypted, such as Signal or WhatsApp. Internet shutdowns make it impossible for you to do that. So not only is the speed at which you're collecting news affected, but the safety of your sources is also affected. And then similarly, on the dissemination side, how do you get the news out if there's no internet? How do you keep the public informed? So in this way, we then see that having an internet shutdown exposes the journalist and their sources and also affects the flow of information. Now, as you said, this is an election year. And in past elections on the continent, we've seen that governments have very readily, very easily reached to internet shutdowns or internet disruptions, you know, often citing security or citing the integrity of the vote as the reason to do that. But those are reasonings that are hollow. And what we hope is that this election year, the government stay away from switching off the internet or disrupting internet access. Now, this hope has already been not met in some of the in some instances. For instance, we can talk about Senegal's elections earlier this year, when we did see internet disruption affecting mobile data. But we hope that as we go on throughout this year, that states recognize how particularly important it is to keep information flowing during the electoral process, and therefore to stay away from hitting, you know, from going dark on the internet or switching off the internet or disrupting it.
That was Mutoki Mumo, Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, speaking with me from Nairobi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Martha Ngoye was the legal executive at South Africa's state-owned passenger rail agency when she blew the whistle on unlawful government contracts worth millions. But instead of being honored as a corruption buster, she was fired and faced a lengthy and costly legal battle to get her job back. Martha's experience highlights the challenges faced by whistleblowers in South Africa. Isan Hafizi has the report.
You know, psychologically as well, it's taken a huge toll psychologically, not only on me, on my daughter as well, and the family as well. But I've been fortunate because I've had a support structure.
While Martha continues the legal fight in court to get her job back, she has joined a newly formed civil society organization called the Whistleblower House, which offers support and advice to whistleblowers in South Africa. At times, whistleblowers have paid the ultimate price in the fight against corruption. In 2021, government employee Babita Diokeran was murdered outside her home after it emerged she had uncovered corruption in the provincial health department. Journalist Jeff Wicks spent months investigating the circumstances that led to her murder.
She was returning home after dropping her daughter at school, and when she slowed to move her car into her driveway, another vehicle pulled up alongside her and three men pumped her car full of bullets, and she was shot 12 times. What we didn't know then, and we only found out subsequently several months later, was that in the weeks before she was killed, she had stumbled across anomalous payment patterns and had reported them to her superiors. She'd wanted an urgent investigation and a stop to the payments. And even just days before she was killed, she sent a message to her boss saying, "These guys might be onto us if we stop their money and our lives might be in danger." And that message turned out to be fairly prescient because she was killed within less than a week.
Cynthia Stumpel is another whistleblower who exposed corruption in South Africa's state-owned airlines. She says whistleblowers are a fundamental component in the fight against corruption.
My own view is that whistleblowers are truly important in fighting corruption because they are the ones who highlight and expose and speak out about either fraud happening in their workplace, corruption, and so they are that first point of call, and we really need to take them seriously rather than victimize them.
The South African government has acknowledged the importance of protecting whistleblowers. It has committed to reviewing the current laws on whistleblowers as part of its national anti-corruption strategy. Dr. Uglesha Radulovic from the University of Johannesburg researches the plight of whistleblowers. He says that changes are required to further strengthen the legislation surrounding the protection of whistleblowers.
So I think what would be crucial would be to revise the legislation to broaden the protection for whistleblowers and to penalize those that are retaliating against whistleblowers. And the second thing that would be crucial would be to create a stronger relationship between the state and civil society, and an independent state institution could provide the resolution there.
At the end of the day, it is important for whistleblowers to speak truth to power. If we really do want change in this country and we want to leave some kind of a legacy and future for our kids, people have got to speak out.
Whistleblowers remain an invaluable resource in the fight against corruption and the protection of democracy. But the whistleblowers we have spoken to believe that they are not getting the support and protection that they so desperately need. Ihsan Hafiji, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
The U.S. state of Florida has a new law banning most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. In this presidential campaign, Donald Trump is defending the right of state to regulate reproductive rights. Joe Biden says that decentralized authority threatens women's lives. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has the story.
The Biden campaign is making reproductive rights a centerpiece of its reelection drive. Vice President Kamala Harris campaigned in Florida the day the state's new abortion law took effect.
This is a fight for freedom, the fundamental freedom to make decisions about one's own body and not have their government tell them what they're supposed to do.
Florida's new abortion law is among the nation's most restrictive and has prompted a November ballot initiative to put abortion rights in the state constitution. U.S. states are making their own abortion laws because a 2022 Supreme Court decision ended federal abortion protections. Trump appointed three of the six justices who decided that case, and Harris says voters need to hold him accountable.
Across our nation, we witness a full-on assault, state by state, on reproductive freedom. And understand who is to blame. Former President Donald Trump did this.
While Trump says the new Florida law goes too far, he regularly takes credit for this state-by-state approach to abortion. It's the will of the people, he explained in a video on his social media site last month.
Many states will be different. Many will have a different number of weeks, or some will have more conservative than others, and that's what they will be. At the end of the day, this is all about the will of the people. You must follow your heart or, in many cases, your religion or your faith.
At a women's health clinic in Fort Pierce, Florida, this patient fears the new law means more young women will die.
I think it means a lot more deaths, honestly, because 6 weeks is not really a lot of time. And then I feel like abortion, it's still going to happen, whether it happens legally or illegally. It'll happen, like, on the streets. It'll just be unsafe.
Clinic owner Candace Dye says there was a rush of patients before the new abortion law. For her, a six-week ban is too restrictive.
And a lot of girls don't even know they're pregnant until they're 6 weeks. You know, they think they're 4 weeks because they haven't seen their period yet. So, and then we do our ultrasound. There are six already, and the patients have to be seen 2 different days.
Outside the clinic, anti-abortion protesters try to engage with each woman who enters. Tammy Holly shares her experience.
I'm here because abortion has hurt me, and I certainly don't want to see other women hurt by abortion. They walk in the door, and they never come out the same. No matter how they try to go on with life as normal, they'll never be the same.
While ending abortion motivates many Republican voters, Trump appears mindful of the issue's political vulnerabilities in a close presidential race.
Always go by your heart, but we must win. We have to win. We are a failing nation, but we can be a failing nation no longer. We will make our nation great.
Harris says Trump's Republican allies in Congress want a nationwide abortion ban. Trump has said that's not necessary now that states can make their own abortion laws. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Kenyan President William Ruto has named Charles Murui Kariri as defense chief. Kariri replaces Francis Omondi Ogolo, who was among 10 military personnel killed when their helicopter crashed on April 18th. The French news agency AFP says Kariri previously served as deputy to Ogolo, who had been chief of defense forces for a year. Among the other appointments, Ruto named Major General Fatuma Gaiti Ahmad as commander of the Kenya Air Force, the first woman to hold the position. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Jumbe Hamza, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.